are you? Horwath asked after a long pause.
I've considered it, Severin said with a shrug. Would I had a man as crafty as Tunmore to serve me.
His face began to darken, his jaw tightening with anger.
I've been reading his book, you know.
He dangled the water skin from one of his gloved fingers, letting it sway back and forth until it almost clapped against his leg.
This is the title. The Occupation of the Throne of Ceredigion by King Severn.
He frowned as he said the words. Owen watched his face closely.
As I read that screed, I swear I almost started believing it. He tells an eloquent tale and comes across as a philosopher, not a Deconius. He was writing it to be published, I think. That city where we caught him is a major trading hub. Imagine how far he could have spread his lies.
He tugged his dagger loose in the scabbard and slammed it down.
But what truly makes me furious, Steve, is how he covered his own part, his own crimes.
What do you mean?
Horwath asked. Severin leaned forward, wincing as if his back were paining him.
I won't even tell you all he said about me. That I was born feet first, with teeth, and only ever kissed those I meant to kill. That I plotted my nephew's deaths from the start.
His breath hissed out with frustration.
Never mind the lies. How can you expect otherwise from a man who lives on the graces of others, one who has committed high treason not once, but twice? No, what angers me most is his complete denial of his own complicity. Remember the plot Catesby told us about? How Tunmore conspired with the others to murder me the morning when we met at Privy Council? How I charged Hastings with high treason, and he confessed all in front of the council?
He clenched his fist with his pent-up emotions, bringing it to his mouth in frustration.
You were there, Steve. Yet in the book, the saintly Deconius of Ely says I asked him to fetch strawberries from his garden. His garden!
He looked nearly apoplectic.
I was nigh on being murdered. My son and wife were to be put in the river or worse, and I asked him for strawberries. And he says that when he went to fetch them, I turned on Hastings and murdered him. I never sent Tunmore away for fruit. He was there the whole time. It's a bald-faced lie, and from a man of the fountain, no less.
He seemed so uncomfortable that he rocked forward and stood, then began pacing.
And the thing is, Steve, the fact of the matter is that while reading it, I wanted to believe it.
He grunted with contempt.
I wanted to believe those lies about myself. Is this what men think of me, Steve? Truly. Not just my enemies, forsooth. But do the common people believe I murdered my nephews? That I conspired and connived for my nephew's throne? I took it, yes. But only after the Deconius of Stillwater told us, that my brother's marriage to his wife was invalid. That would make all of his children illegitimate. Can I believe that of my brother? Of course I can. He was a rake. He had our brother Dunsworth killed because he learned of it. By the fountain, does everyone see me this way? That I would murder my brother's sons after snatching the throne from them.
His face was a rictus of frustration. He never looked down at Horwath. He wasn't truly seeking an answer.
My lord, my hair and beard are quite gray,
Horwath said in a low, coaxing tone.
So I suppose it entitles me to some wisdom about the nature of men. It has been my experience that while it's easy to persuade most men of some new thing, it is more difficult to fix them in that persuasion. In the end, the truth will out eventually.
The king folded his arms imperiously and gave the old man a curious look.
The truth will out,
he said, his tone showing he was not fully convinced. Their attention was diverted with the arrival of a horse, a lathered monster of a beast holding the panting, disheveled, and thoroughly exhausted Dominique Mancini.
You've arrived just in time to leave,
The king snorted contemptuously.
My lord,
the man wheezed, trying to catch his breath.
You keep a hazardous pace. Horse flesh was not intended to work this hard. I implore your majesty to slow down. Or do you mean your flesh?
The king said with a chuckle. He clapped Horwath's shoulder.
Onward, lads! I've ridden nearly every corner of this kingdom on my brother's orders. He said a soldier should always know the ground he travels. Where are the fens and fords? Where are the falls? Over yonder, he added, pointing, is an estuary called the Stroud. At the head of that muggy estuary is a little castle called Gloucester. My brother made me its duke and the constable of that castle on my 9th birthday.
He looked down at Owen, his face scrutinizing the young boy, who was nearing his 9th birthday.
Loyalty bound me, and it still does.
The king slapped his thighs.
That's where we will be spending the night.
Horwath whistled through his teeth. Owen had the sense that it would be a long journey. The king smirked.
Try to keep up, Master Mancini. Or at the least, try not to kill the horse or yourself getting there. I don't think the princes of the various realms fully appreciate that King Severn Argentine is first and foremost a soldier. Or maybe they do, and that's why they fear him so much. We rode 35 leagues in a single day, changing horses 3 times at various castles. We did not make it to Gloucester until well after midnight, but the king's energy only improved as the day waned. I am nearly fainting with fatigue. If I were to guess, the king intends to swoop down on Westmarch unexpectedly, for we are traveling faster than pigeons can fly. Even if Anchoret left before us, I don't see how she can reach Tattenhall first.
Dominique Mancini, Espion of the Piebald Nag. Chapter 34. Beestone. The royal palace in Westmarch had been dubbed Beestone Castle, although it was not clear why. The reason for the location was much more apparent, for it had been built on Castle Hill, overlooking the city of Knotsbury and its surrounding valleys and farms. It was an impressive castle, a royal castle, with squat round towers on each side of the main gate and drawbridge, and the entire hill was enclosed by thick, sturdy walls. Sharp, stony cliffs surrounded the circumference of the hill, making the castle impregnable to attack and able to withstand sieges. It was not opulent, but it was safe and secure. Right now the main bailey was teeming with horses and soldiers bearing the colors and badges of the White Boar. Archers strolled the ramparts, and Owen spied the king's flag fluttering from pennants overhanging the walls. Amidst such confusion, no one took much notice of the small little boy sneaking around and exploring the castle from one end to the other. It was much smaller than King Fountain, he soon realized, and the wind here was sharp and cool. The view from the bulwarks was impressive, but Tattenhall was too far away to see. Owen felt uneasy and wondered how Anchoret was going to find him. The royal retinue would not be arriving with the baggage carts from King Fountain for several more days. As a result, there were mostly soldiers around the grounds. A woman would surely stand out among them, but Owen was confident that she would find a way. While he was wandering the battlement walls, a squire bearing the badge of Duke Horwath found him and took him to the royal apartments where the king was meeting with the duke. There were knights and servants coming in and out of the sitting room, heralds waiting to bring messages. Owen looked at all the tall men and felt out of place as the only child among them. He missed Evie and wished she were here to explore the castle with him. He missed his tiles, too, and the serenity they gave him. While the adults were talking, Owen found a wiser set by the table near the king's luggage and began playing with it and admiring the pieces. Then he noticed the black book on top of a chest. It felt like his stomach was suddenly full of worms, all wriggling and twisting. The book seemed to call to him, whispering to him to open it. He glanced over at Duke Horwath and the king, but the king was doing most of the talking, and his back was to Owen. The king's hand tugged on his dagger hilt in his habitual nervous gesture. He looked tall and strong, and while one of his shoulders was slightly higher than the other, his posture and gestures seemed to hide the fact. Owen glanced back at the book. He had a craving to start reading it. If he stole it, he knew it would be missed, but what if he could learn something about his family in it? Something that could help them? He knew what Elizabeth Victoria Mortimer would do. He reached into his pocket and rubbed his thumb on the braid she had cut off and given him. Then, steeling himself, he inched his way over to the bed as if he were merely curious. His fingers shook a little as he reached out and touched the book's binding. He glanced back one more time, and when he saw everyone else was still thoroughly engrossed in conversation, he carefully opened the book and started reading.
The Occupation of the Throne of Ceredigion by King Severn, unfinished, written by Master John Tunmore. King Eridor, of that name the Fourth, after he had lived 50 and 3 years, 7 months and 6 days, and thereof reigned 22 years, 1 month and 8 days, died at King Fountain the 9th day of Averill, leaving much fair issue. He was poisoned.
Owen started when he heard the whisper in his mind. A tremulous feeling began to unfurl inside him. As soon as he had started to read the little black book, a gentle murmuring sound began to fill his ears, so subtle he had not noticed it swelling. Then the thought struck him with the force of a blow. King Eridor had been poisoned. Owen blinked, feeling giddy and worried at the same time. He kept reading.
That is, to wit, Eridor the Crown Prince, a lad 13 years of age. Eric, Duke of York, age 10. Elizabeth, the eldest, fairest princess of the realm, whose fortune and grace are those of a queen. Celia, not so fortunate as fair. Bridget the Virtuous. This noble prince of great fame, Eridor, deceased at his palace of King Fountain, and, with great funeral honor and heaviness of his people, was put in a royal barge and commended to the river in the hopes that he would become the dreadful dead-man prophecy fulfilled and return from the watery grave. His body was taken by the fountain, not seen hence.
Eridor was not the dreadful dead-man.
Owen started again when the voice whispered to him. His stomach clenched and twisted, his heart feeling like the burning coals in the brazier nearby. Owen was so wrapped up in reading, he could hear nothing else in the room. His eyes were fixed on the page. He read next about how Eridor had taken the throne and the wars that had happened along the way. Much of this history he had learned from Anchoret.
Many nobles of the realm at Wakefield were slain, leaving 3 sons, Eridor, Dunsworth, and Severn. All 3, as they were great princes of birth, were great and stately. Greedy and ambitious of authority, and impatient of partners. Eridor, revenging his father's death, attained the crown. Lord Dunsworth was a goodly, noble prince, and at all points fortunate, if his own ambition had not set him against his brother, and the envy of his enemies had not set his brother against him. For were it by the queen and the lords of her blood, the king was persuaded to hate his own brother or the proud appetite of the duke himself, intending to be king. Lord Dunsworth was charged with heinous treason, and finally, attainted was he and judged to the death. Not thrown in the river, but drowned in a keg of wine. Whose death King Eridor, when he knew it was done, piteously bewailed and sorrowfully repented.
Dunsworth was poisoned by Anchoret Trelawney. His craving of power and wealth made him go mad, chasing the treasure in the cistern waters. Dunsworth was not the dreadful dead man.
If the walls of the palace crumbled around him, Owen would not have noticed. He was so engrossed in the book he could not pull his eyes away. He read on.
Severn, the 3rd son, of whom we now entreat, was in intellect and courage equal with either of his brothers, in body and prowess far beneath them both. Little of stature, ill-featured of limbs, crook-backed, his left shoulder much higher than his right, hard-favored of visage and warlike in his demeanor. He was malicious, wrathful, envious, and, from afore his birth, ever perverse. It is for truth reported that the Duchess his mother had so much ado in her travail that she could not be delivered of him uncut, and, as the fame runneth, also not untoothed. Able captain was he in war, for which his disposition was much better met than for peace. He was close and secret, a deep dissembler, lowly of countenance, arrogant of heart. Outwardly companionable where he inwardly hated, not refraining to kiss those whom he thought to kill, dispiteous and cruel, not for evil, but often for ambition, he slew with his own hand. The book was suddenly snatched out of Owen's hands, and Ratcliffe waggled it over his head. "Do you see what the lad is reading, my lord? Look at him, he was transfixed." He then whapped the side of Owen's head with the book and gave him a shove. Duke Horwath stepped forward, putting himself between Owen and Ratcliffe.
"He was reading it, you say?"
the king asked, suddenly interested and concerned.
"Did you not see him?"
Ratcliffe said sharply.
"I saw him,"
came another voice, much younger. Owen glared at Dunsworth, who had appeared in the doorway and was giving him a malicious smile. In Owen's mind, he saw a man inside a bucket, clawing at the bottom as if trying to reach a treasure he could not grab. The vision was enough to make him shudder. But the king stepped forward, blocking his view of Dunsworth.
"You were reading my book?"
Owen had been caught. There was no denying it. His tongue felt like it was sticking to the roof of his mouth. Fear made him want to cower, but he reached inside his pocket and gripped the braid of Elizabeth's hair.
"I wanted to play wiser," Owen said, his mouth finally able to move. "But everyone was talking, so I started playing with the pieces. Then I saw the book."
"Did you understand it?"
the king asked incredulously. Owen nodded.
"There are hard words in there, lad. It's not a child's book. Did you truly understand its meaning?"
Owen stared at the king, whose eyes were now boring into his.
"I like books," he said sheepishly.
The king snatched the book from Ratcliffe's hand and then thumbed through it.
"I like books under normal circumstances, but this book, there are falsehoods written in it, falsehoods about me."
"I know," Owen said, nodding. The king's brow wrinkled.
"What do you mean, you know?"
Owen blinked, feeling more and more confused. How did he know? How could he describe the voice he'd heard while reading it?
I felt it as I read,"
Owen said simply.
"I felt the parts that weren't true."
The king's eyes narrowed.
"We will speak of this later,"
he murmured, then stuffed the book into his belt.
"Dunsworth, play wiser with the lad."
The older boy scowled fiercely at the command, and Owen groaned inwardly as he walked to the wiser board. Dunsworth sulked as he took up the white pieces and set them up, incorrectly. It hurt to watch him, but Owen gritted his teeth, knowing Dunsworth wouldn't care the pieces were in the wrong positions.
"What news from Tadden Hall?"
the king demanded of Ratcliffe in an undertone. Owen had clearly not heard the spymaster or Dunsworth enter the room earlier, for he had been too caught up in reading the book. As Owen silently began moving pieces, he kept his eyes on the game board while his ears listened keenly to the king's conversation.
"I hate this game," Dunsworth seethed.
"I hate you," Owen almost said, but managed to bite his tongue in time.
"As you requested, my lord, I delivered your summons to Duke Kiskadden at Beestone Castle. As you can imagine, he wanted to know the nature of the summons. I explained that you were holding the Assizes. He then had the temerity to ask whether he would be participating in the Assizes as a justice."
Ratcliffe chuckled.
And what did you tell him?
The king asked with amusement.
I said, of course, that Duke Horwath was the chief justice, and he would learn more when he obeyed the summons.
Do you think he will come, Dickon?
The king asked softly.
If he doesn't, he's guilty of treason. If he does, he'll be found guilty of treason. Either way, we have him.
There are three estuaries with ports in Westmarch,
the king said.
Mold and Runcen in the south, and Blackpool in the north. No one sails from any of those ports without my approval, and the king of Aquitania would not want his territory to help Kiskadin. The only place he can go is Sanctuary. And you can be sure we have Espeon watching all of them and watching the estate. He won't be able to use the privy without us knowing.
There was a smile in the king's voice.
Thank you, Dickon. You've done well. It's time for the lad to see his parents again. You told them I brought the boy with me?
Indeed, my lord. They know the price for open treason.
He was guilty of that at Ambion Hill. Steve, how long would it take for him to summon his retainers and an army from the borderlands?
Duke Horwath's voice was gruff.
Do you think he will, my lord?
Beastone has 1,000 men, and more have been arriving all day. 1,000 more will join us from the north. How many can Kiskadin summon, and how quickly?
Only a few hundred men by tomorrow, maybe half of that. It would take him a fortnight to collect the rest of those who owe him service, and I doubt they would join him against you now that you are already established here. You didn't give him enough time to react.
The king chuckled.
That was my intent. The wolf is at the door, the sheep are bleating. What will you do next, Kiskadin? It's your move.
Owen made his final move, having defeated Dunsworth in 5 turns. His stomach was twisting into knots. Dunsworth grunted with disgust at the loss and swore under his breath. When Owen made it to his bedchamber after the evening meal, his thoughts whirling with both what he had read and what he had overheard, he realized that his parents had failed their test of loyalty and his own life hung in the balance. He stopped in surprise. On the floor in his room was the satchel he had left behind at King Fountain. Tiles on the floor spelled his name. O-W-E-N.
My master taught me certain maxims. A prince ought to inspire fear in such a way that if he does not win love, he avoids hatred. He can avoid the hatred of his people as long as he abstains from the property of his subjects and from their women. But when it becomes necessary for him to proceed against the life of someone, especially one of the nobles who hold so much power, he must do it with proper justification. But above all things, he must keep his hands off the property of others, because men will more quickly forget the death of their father than the loss of their patrimony. History teaches this plainly. And many a king has lost his crown after stealing what belonged to another man. It's ironic that even though it causes more trouble to take away land than to kill, it's more difficult to find justification to take someone's life. That's why it's best to strike your enemy down after he's given you the opportunity to do so. The Assizes of Westmarch are just such a pretext.
Dominic Mancini, exhausted Espeon of Beastone Castle. Chapter 35. Well of Tears. It was after nightfall, but there were enough torches to illuminate the castle bailey as if it were day. There was no end to the clattering of wagons as arrivals from the king's court continued to ascend to Beastone Castle throughout the night. Soldiers wearing the badge of the White Boar were everywhere, but Owen made his way through the bailey yard anyway, careful to keep away from adults who might send him to bed. After seeing his name spelled with tiles, he had been searching for Anchoret. In the center of the courtyard was a raised well made of stone and mortar. Owen clambered up onto the edge of it and stared down into the black depths. He could hear a faint gurgling, but it was too deep for him to see the shimmer of water. The sound of boots coming up behind him warned him that he was no longer alone, and he scuttled back from the edge as Mancini approached, holding a gleaming florin in his hand.
"Ready to make another wish?"
the fat man asked with a grin. He offered the coin to the boy, putting Owen in mind of their meeting long ago at Our Lady. The boy shook his head. Mancini pursed his lips and nodded knowingly.
"I agree. It's a waste of a good coin. I mean, look at this piece. I could buy several muffins with it and gain an hour's satisfaction. Or I can plop it down a well shaft and never gain a single thing from it. If wishes were horses, beggars would ride, eh?"
Mancini sat on the edge of the well next to Owen, folding his meaty arms over his chest. He clucked his tongue softly.
"Frankly, lad, I don't see how she can pull this one off. The guards at the gate are letting only Espion pass back out. The baggage continues to arrive, but not are leaving. Word amongst us is your lord father has ridden down from Tatton Hall with an escort of 100 men. He's camped about a league away from the city. Doesn't look good for him."
Owen's twisting nerves grew worse.
"I trust her," he whispered softly.
"Trust is a pretty dish, lad. But this is the king's trust we are talking about. If I were in Severn's place, I'd use the Assizes to my advantage to destroy a threat known to me. A dish may be a pretty thing, but it's easily broken. Even if you fit the pieces back together, it won't hold a meal. Your father broke the king's trust at Ambion Hill. Your brother already paid for that with his life. Bets are being waged among the Espion that your father will go into the river tomorrow."
He clapped Owen on the back.
"I hate to bear bad news, but I just don't see how Anchoret can change his mind."
Anger churning in his heart, Owen gave Mancini a sulky look.
"She's more clever than you, though. She'll think of a way."
Mancini snorted.
"Well, if she's slipped into the castle, she won't be slipping out, I can tell you that."
"You sound very sure of yourself."
It was Anchoret's voice ghosting up to them from the lip of the well. Owen startled, and Mancini had to lurch forward to keep from falling backward into the well in pure surprise. Owen's faith in the queen's poisoner had been vindicated once again. He leaned over the edge of the well, staring down into its dark throat.
"Are you down in the well?"
he whispered, his voice echoing down the shaft.
"I am,"
she replied, her voice kind but tired.
"I can't see you," Owen said. "But I can see you," she answered. "All is well."
"I'm beginning to believe in all this fountain nonsense,"
Mancini grumbled nastily, having partially recovered from his shock.
"Where are you?"
"There are tunnels honeycombing beneath the castle," she whispered. "It's one of the reasons that castle was named Beestone. This is a famous castle, Owen, or an infamous one. Several kings have started their reign here. Studying the past sometimes helps us make the future. Dominique, have you found what I asked you to find?"
Owen gripped the edge, his heart afire with hope. The spy frowned distastefully.
"Yes, but it's not good news, Anchoret. It would seem the king means to execute the lad's family tomorrow. I was just telling him that. The Espion are all betting on it, coins changing hands."
"Thank you. Yes, it does seem very likely that the king will make an announcement tomorrow. This is the bit of news I needed to confirm. Do you know what time the Assizes will start? When must Kiskaden arrive before he's guilty of treason?"
Mancini frowned, his arms folded.
10th hour. I heard he's camped a league away."
"Dominique, I need you to go to him. I can't ride that far and be back in time. You must go to Lord Kiskaden, and you must tell him to come to the Assizes tomorrow. He cannot be late."
"Why would he listen to me?"
Mancini said.
"Because I sent you. He will trust you because his wife trusts me. Believe this.
You must persuade Owen's father to come without a retinue, without arms. He must put himself completely at the king's mercy.
Owen shivered. The incredulous look on Mancini's face said it all.
Are you serious?
Quite so. You must deliver this message for me, tonight. If you leave now, you can be at his camp and back before dawn. See if you can persuade him to come with you. He cannot be late to the Assizes. Will you do this?
I'm risking my neck, Mancini grumbled. Will you not tell me your plan? I haven't been able to get the book. The king keeps it with him at all times.
He's struggling to understand what is written in it. I need to know what's in that book.
But the king won't let go, Mancini said.
He's not the only one who's read it. Where are the Espions staying? Where is Ratcliffe?
What?
Where is Ratcliffe?
More insistently this time.
All the Espion are staying at the Holywell in town. It's near Castle Hill on the...
I know it,
she said, cutting him off. Her voice sounded more tired, more pained.
Go, Dominic. Go warn Kiskaden.
The spy grunted as he leaned away from the well and marched off toward the torchlight. Owen was grateful he was gone.
Are you feeling sick?
Owen whispered into the well. There was a long pause.
I'm very sick, Owen, and we're running out of time.
He fidgeted nervously.
I wish there was a way I could help,
he said miserably.
I saw the book on the king's bed today. I started reading it, but Ratcliffe took it away.
That was clever of you,
she said, sounding pleased.
You could tell John Tunmore is fountain blessed just from reading it, couldn't you?
Yes,
Owen said.
Anchoret, what is the dreadful dead man?
She was quiet a moment.
How do you know about that name?
She finally asked.
Was it in the book?
In a way,
he answered, feeling confused.
While I was reading the book, I heard the name. I heard it twice. The voice said King Eridor wasn't a dreadful dead man. Then it said Lord Dunsworth, not the boy, but his father, was also not the dreadful dead man. What is it?
I don't know for certain,
Anchoret said, her voice soft and subdued.
It is a superstition, mostly. One that is whispered about late at night. It is a legend of the first king of Ceredigion, the one who ruled before Aquitania invaded our lands. I told you before of his wiser. Myrddin was fountain-blessed and could see the future. There are stories that he left a prophecy. Before he disappeared, he said that the first king of Ceredigion would return someday. He would come back from the dead to rule Ceredigion and Aquitania. This prophecy was named the Dreadful Deadman, for when he returns, there will be much war and bloodshed. This legend is not written down, but the people believe in it. It is rumor ladled on gossip and served in a trencher of lies. King Eridor claimed he was the Dreadful Deadman. It's a ploy many have used to become king. But that is the nature of prophecies. They are much speculated about. I know the Aquitanians fear this prophecy. To them it is certainly dreadful. But in this case, Owen, I cannot tell you what is true and what is false. I do not know.
Owen rubbed his hand over the cool, smooth stone of the well. He kept staring into the depths, wishing he could see her.
Are you truly down there?
He asked.
I am,
she answered, a smile in her voice.
Now, you said you wished you could help.
Can I?
He asked, growing more hopeful.
Owen, you are the biggest help of all. You are the one who is going to save your family.
He leaned forward so far he almost fell in.
Really?
How?
You are going to tell the king your family is guilty of treason.
His hope suddenly wilted.
Anchorette?
Listen to me, my boy. The verdict of the Assizes has already been determined. There must be enough evidence in that book to condemn your parents. I cannot do anything about that. The king has already made up his mind. He will use Duke Horoth to execute his will and deliver the king's justice. No matter what is said tomorrow at the Assizes, your family will be declared guilty of treason and will be attainted. Do you know that word?
No,
Owen groaned miserably. He wanted to be sick.
Attainder means the forfeiture of land and rights as a consequence of a sentence of death for treason or felony. It means the king will strip away Westmarch from your family and put them to death. Then he can claim the duchy as royal lands or give them to another person. That is what happens. That is what is going to happen tomorrow. What I need to know is what is in that book. Because you are going to have a dream tonight, Owen. And you are going to share it with the king before the Assizes begins. You will confess your family's treason. That exhibition of your power will not only astonish the king, but the fact that you used it to benefit him will put you in a position of trust. The Assizes, Owen, is your test of loyalty. Your parents have already failed theirs. They failed it months ago when your father didn't fight for the king at Ambion Hill until it was too late. Your father is useless to the king now, for he can never trust him again. What Severn needs to know is if you will be faithful to him.
Owen felt tears stinging his eyes.
But I don't want my family to die, he gasped.
He felt utterly miserable.
I know,
Anchorette soothed, her voice thickening with pain.
But you can save them, Owen. Listen. Don't let your grief run away with you.
I'm doing the best I can to help you.
Her voice trailed off and Owen stifled his own sobs, wanting so much to reach into the black hole to comfort her.
Listen to me,
she whispered, her voice so soft.
Your dream will reveal your parents' treason. I will find out what's in the black book so I can tell you tonight. It will solidify your reputation as one who can see the future.
But how?
Owen asked, confused.
What my parents did was in the past. Why would knowing that convince the king I can see the future?
The sound of approaching boots met his ears, and when he looked up, he saw Duke Horoth approaching, a look of concern on his face.
He's coming,
Owen whimpered nervously.
Listen carefully,
Anchorette said.
Even if someone is attainted, found guilty, the king can show mercy and pardon them. We will make the future. Your dream will predict that the king will pardon your family and banish them from the realm. Exile. That is what your dream must tell him. I will work out the details tonight. I'll find you before dawn.
He's almost here, Owen warned.
And in your dream,
she whispered, her voice ghosting up from the well hole.
The rat dies.
Lord Kiskaden is a broken man, a husk. He's a man standing on the brink of a waterfall, seeing the rushing waters whisking him toward his doom. Flail as he might, he cannot escape the current. He was almost too willing to speak to a total stranger, a Genovese no less. His greatest regret? That Tunmore's book reveals his wife was his partner in all things. She helped arrange and receive the messages from the pretend king who was slain at Ambion Hill. Their entire family is going to be shoved into the river after the Assizes. Well, all except one. Kiskaden has come to Beastone Castle to beg for a pardon he won't be getting.
Dominique Mancini, espion of the Assizes.
I'm in shock. When I got back to the tavern, all was in an uproar. Anchorette is dead. Apparently, she went after Ratcliffe at the Espion stronghold. I've heard only snippets, but she blew powder in his face to drug him. She was discovered by my colleagues and stabbed to death. There were easily a dozen men with blood on their shirts and daggers. Ratcliffe survived a neck wound, unfortunately, and has gone to the king in triumph. They've taken her corpse to the castle.
What was she trying to accomplish? I have no idea.
I saw her body myself, lying on a cold stone slab in the doctor's chambers. Everyone is afraid to even touch her. Pale as marble she is. Pale and beautiful in death.
Dominique Mancini, espion of the doomed boy. Chapter 36. The White Pig. Owen was awakened by the touch of a woman's fingers on his hair. The room was dark, but it was the birth of dawn. It was the time just before the birds started to sing, the cusp of a new day, the deep breath before the plunge. The royal apartments in Beeston Castle were furnished and unfamiliar. As Owen blinked awake, it took him a moment to place himself. Was he in Tatton Hall? King Fountain? He saw Anchorette kneeling beside the bed, her cheek resting on the mattress, her fingers playing absently with tufts of his hair. She had a languid smile on her pale face. A shudder rippled through her, and she bent her lips to the mattress to muffle a little cough. Then she gazed fondly at him again.
Anchorette,
Owen whispered, feeling his heart lighten. He rubbed his eyes on his hand.
I tried to stay awake. I fell asleep waiting for you. It's all right, Owen, she soothed. I was late,
she smiled. You're quite pale, the boy said, feeling concern. She looked as if that didn't matter at all.
I feel tired. I need a long sleep, like you've had.
She pinched his cheek tenderly and grazed it with her thumb.
Shall I tell you about your dream? Will you be able to remember it?
He nodded eagerly and stared into her eyes, lost in them for a moment.
After I've told you, she said softly, you need to go to the king, right away. You need to be brave, little Owen. Can you do that?
I have Evie's braid. I can be brave like her. Owen sat up and noticed that she did not. She was kneeling at the edge of the bed, holding herself up on her arms.
Very well. Listen carefully. You had a dream tonight. In the dream, three golden bucks came to Beeston Castle. The bucks all knelt before a white pig. You saw their antlers touch the ground before the pig. Then a rat with a knife walked up to the bucks to kill them and eat them. But the white pig shook its snout. It wouldn't let the rat hurt the bucks. The pig walked to the river, and the bucks followed. All of them boarded a boat except for one. The smallest of the bucks stayed with the pig. The boat went against the current of the river, upstream instead of down, and sailed away to a land of flowers. She stiffened and let out a soft breath of pain. She blinked, her eyes growing dazed. Owen. Then the pig sniffed the rat. When it did, it found a gold coin in its fur. The pig turned into a boar and grew tusks. With the tusks, the boar threw the rat into the river, and it drowned.
Her fingers, which had been playing in his hair, went limp, and her wrist sagged to the mattress blanket. Her head lolled to one side.
Anchorette?
Owen asked worriedly.
So sleepy,
she whispered. She blinked rapidly, then lifted her head. Her eyes seemed to sharpen and focus.
Now go tell the king about your dream. This is important, Owen. This is how you can save your family.
She gave him a tender look, so poignant and full of love. Her weak fingers lifted and grazed the white patch of his hair.
Go. And tell me what happens. Will you be here when I get back?
Owen asked, his worry growing.
I promise,
she answered, smiling sadly. Owen scuttled off the edge of the bed and quickly threw on his clothes. He made sure Evie's braid was in his pocket, and he walked away from his room, wandering the halls. He saw Mancini slumped in the corridor, a jug of wine crooked in his arm.
Take me to the king's room,
Owen told the espion, tugging on his sleeve. Mancini looked haggard, depressed, and irritable. His eyes opened slowly. His breath was awful.
You,
he said, looking pained.
Where is it? I need to tell the king about my dream.
What dream?
Mancini said in confusion.
There are no more dreams. There is no more hope. It's all been ruined. All is lost.
He shook the empty jug a little, listening to see if there was any liquid sloshing around inside. It was empty.
Anchorette said I must,
Owen insisted, gripping the man's shoulder. Mancini's face crinkled with confusion.
Who said?
Anchorette,
Owen seethed, frustrated at the man's blockheadedness. Mancini leaned forward.
You've seen her?
She's in my room.
Owen hooked his thumb and pointed. The expression on Mancini's face transformed. He shoved away the empty jug and broke it in his haste to get back to his feet.
She is? At this very moment? But how?
Owen said, for he heard the sound of boots coming. Mancini grabbed the boy's hand and marched him down the hall. He swayed a bit as he walked, but he knew the way. Coming toward them were several night guards wearing the badge of the White Boar and carrying torches. One of the soldiers challenged them.
Who goes there? This is the Cascadin brat, boy. He had another dream and must tell it to the king.
The soldier looked at Owen in surprise.
Follow us, boy.
Mancini's cheeks were pink and rosy, and he looked elated. They marched back the way they had come and quickly went to the king's bedchamber. As soon as they walked into the room, Owen saw Duke Horwath. Ratcliffe was also there, a bloody bandage around his neck, along with several other men who were talking angrily amongst themselves. To Owen's surprise, Princess Elise was also present, wearing a robe over her nightdress, her hair straggling as she paced the chamber in her slippers, her face pinched with worry.
My liege,
the soldier announced, stamping his boots as he halted.
Found these two in the corridors. The boy has had another dream.
The king, looking furious, turned when he saw the soldier's announcement. His face was flushed with emotion, but he calmed when he saw Owen.
Another one?
The king asked. His voice suddenly interested and concerned, he started walking toward Owen.
My lord, Ratcliffe broke in, that can wait. You promised my reward. I have served you faithfully. I want Tatton Hall.
The princess glowered at Ratcliffe, her face showing her absolute disapproval. Horwath looked angry too, his stern lips pressed hard together.
Give it a rest, Dickon,
the king snapped.
This is important.
Ratcliffe seethed with fury.
If you are still taking the espion away from me, I deserve something in return. Something that won't be a loss of reputation. If this is how you reward loyalty.
The king was in no mood to hear him. His cheeks were full of stubble, and he looked as if he hadn't slept well or at all that night. It reminded Owen of the night he had found the secret tunnel leading to the king's bedroom. The king's face was full of weariness and agitation. but it softened when he dropped down on one knee in front of the boy, putting their eyes on a level.
"What is it, lad?"
he asked in a kindly voice.
"Tell me of your dream."
Everyone was staring at Owen. The soldiers, Duke Horwath, the princess, Ratcliffe, the king. All their eyes bored into him, all their ears listened, and he realized he had power over these men. A king was kneeling in front of him, because he believed Owen was fountain-blessed and could read the future. He was convinced. All Owen needed to do was speak. His tongue grew thick in his mouth. The pressure of being the focus of so much pointed attention unearthed his hidden terrors and fears, which came popping up from the ground like worms after a rainstorm. Owen dug his hand into his pocket and felt the reassuring touch of his friend's hair. He wished she were there. He could almost see her in his mind's eye, standing behind the king with an impatient look. "Just tell him!"
"My lord,"
Ratcliffe interrupted, suddenly nervous.
"It's so early. Wouldn't it be better to hear the lad later, during breakfast? The queen's poisoner is dead, so you need not fear your meals now. It's nearly dawn. Surely this can wait."
The queen's poisoner was dead? Owen's stomach took an uneasy flop. The king's hand rested on the boy's shoulder.
"Tell me,"
he said. Owen licked his lips. He tried to speak, but his tongue wouldn't work. A worried spurt of panic enveloped his gut. Was Anchoret dying? No. She had said she would wait for him to return. She was tired, that was all. Owen forced himself to concentrate. "Go ahead," Princess Elise said coaxingly.
"My lord,"
Ratcliffe whined.
"Shut it,"
Horwath barked at him.
"I did have a dream," Owen said, looking into the king's gray eyes.
A wavering smile hovered on the king's mouth, encouraging him to continue.
"In the dream, I saw three golden bucks. They had big antlers, though one of the bucks was small. They came walking across a field. There was a white pig in the field, a happy pig. The bucks knelt before the pig, their antlers touching the ground. While they were kneeling, a rat with a knife approached them."
Owen swallowed, feeling the hate burning at him from Ratcliffe's eyes. He focused on the king's face.
"The rat wanted to slaughter the bucks, to eat them."
"This is intolerable," muttered Ratcliffe desperately.
The king held up his other hand, cutting him off.
"Go on."
"The white pig shook its snout. It would not let the rat hurt the deer."
Owen swallowed again, squirming. He understood the dream. He understood what Anchoret was trying to do.
The white pig couldn't trust the bucks, though, and so he went with them to the river."
The king's grip on his shoulder tightened, almost painfully. His eyes stared into Owen's eyes with a look of shock.
"Listen to him, my lord,"
Ratcliffe said suddenly, his tone changing.
"The pig could not trust the bucks," Owen went on. "They had not defended the pig when hunters were trying to kill him. So the pig, the white pig, put the bucks on a boat in the river, and he sent them to another land, a land full of flowers. The boat sailed upstream, away from the falls. Only one of the bucks stayed behind. The littlest buck stayed by the pig. It stayed right next to the pig."
Owen's voice trailed off, almost to a whisper. The king was hanging on his every word. Then Owen lifted his voice again.
"What happened next was the pig sniffed at the rat. I think it was smelly. And there in the rat's fur was a gold coin. The pig grew tusks like a boar. And with the tusks, it threw the rat in the river. The rat drowned."
There was a series of gasps when he spoke the final part. The king was astonished. His eyes were so curious, his expression so moved with emotion. that he pressed several fingers against his lips, but he kept his other hand on Owen's shoulder. Suddenly, Owen heard the rushing of the fountain. The sound filled his ears, and the king's hand tightened on his shoulder. Owen felt the magic rushing down the king's arm.
Can you hear me?
It was the king's voice in Owen's mind.
Yes.
The king blinked, but did not seem surprised.
You know what your dream means, don't you, Owen?
Yes. It means my parents are guilty of treason. I know that now.
The king quivered with suppressed emotions. His eyes were fierce.
You know, then, that I have to punish them. I cannot trust them. I cannot let your father serve me. Owen, you must understand this. I must destroy them or risk an even worse betrayal. Owen, please understand, I don't wish to hurt you. But I cannot let them escape, not when I have the power to stop further mischief. A prince must make difficult decisions betimes. A prince must destroy his enemies when he has the chance.
Owen felt the power of the fountain rushing through him. The king was using his power to convince him that his parents must die. He could tell that the king truly believed he had no choice. That wisdom and prudence demanded justice for his parents' involvement at Ambion Hill. Owen was utterly convinced it was just. But he also realized the king was using the magic of the fountain on him. And so he turned it back against him.
But a king can pardon an enemy, Owen thought in response. You have that right and that power. My dream tells you the fountain's will for my parents and its will for me. I will serve you. I will take their place.
Owen looked deep into the king's eyes.
I know you didn't murder your nephews. I know you care for your niece and would never hurt her. And I know you won't hurt me. You are not the monster others pretend you are. I trust you.
The king let go of Owen's shoulder as if it burned him. He rose to his feet, staggering backward in surprise and shock, his face totally unmasked of pretense and cunning. Owen's words had cut him to his very center, had tapped into the secret need of his heart, the need to be loved and trusted by a child after the loss of his own son and his nephews.
"Uncle, are you unwell?"
Elise said, rushing to him in concern. He was trembling, his entire body quaking with emotion. Tears trickled down the king's cheeks, and then, falling to his knees in front of them all, the king wept.
The wish to acquire more is admittedly a very natural and common thing, and when men succeed, they are praised rather than condemned. But when they lack the ability to do so, and yet want to acquire more at all costs, they deserve condemnation for their mistakes.
Dominique Mancini, Espion of the Palace Kitchen. Chapter 37. The Queen's Midwife.
What is the meaning of this, Horwath? Unhand me, I say!
The voice was Ratcliffe's, and the attention of those gathered in the royal chamber shifted from the grieving king and his niece to the master of the Espion. On Horwath's barked command, several soldiers wearing the arrow-pierced lion had marched forward and seized Ratcliffe. Horwath's face was impassive, cold, and very menacing.
"Search him," he ordered brusquely.
"This is outrageous!"
Ratcliffe snarled, struggling against the soldiers, but he was quickly overpowered.
"What do you hope to find? A bag of gold? Of course I have a bag of gold! This is preposterous!"
"My Lord Duke,"
one of the soldiers said, bringing forth a folded scrap of paper, the red waxy seal already broken.
It was in his pocket.
Ratcliffe's eyes widened with shock.
Where did you get that?